Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast.
This week,
we discuss the Haringey development vehicle. No, wait, come back, it's really interesting.
We discuss the Conservatives' lack of a message.
And we talk about whether or not Graham Brady and the 1922 committee would bring down Theresa May. So, this doesn't promise to be the most exciting topic, but please bear with us, because I think we can make it exciting, can't we, Stephen?
If I'm going to say... Find out.
Yeah, no promises. If I say the words Haringey development vehicle to you, what do you say?
I admit a low groan.
Can you explain this to me? Because I think this is one of those things that has become a kind of emblematic row in the party. And there are some things you need to know about it, and there are probably some things you don't. But essentially, it was a council proposal from a North London council about redeveloping land and bringing in new housing, which has either been seen as, yes, there are some downsides to this, but this is the only way we're going to get new housing and upgrade some stuff, versus this is a sort of Tory-lite plot to kind of winkle out existing residents from their homes. I mean, that's a slight caricature, but that's what I got from it.
The objection people have against it kind of splits into a couple of facts. There's the, it will dispossess too many existing tenants. There's the, these public sector private partnerships don't work. And then there are people who have specific worries about Lendlease with relation to promises made in Southwark.
Do you mean the Haygate estate?
Yeah, that people feel were not kept.
So I think there has been a big problem. I mean, the one that's the Haygate is a redevelopment in Elephant and Castle. And there was an idea that they would use... So when they redevelop land, there's a thing called Section 120, which is the idea that you have to provide a certain amount of affordable housing. Now, notoriously, developers are brilliant at winkling out of this, and it gets whittled away because they say, oh no, we're actually not going to make enough profits on it. So what happened in the Haygate was a lot of people got displaced from their houses with the presumption that actually they would bring all this stuff would come in. It would be like new, amazing, like squash courts or whatever it would be. And actually that stuff got whittled and whittled away. So people felt that what had happened, essentially a private developer had been able to make a lot of money and they hadn't had any of the things they were promised. So that's sort of some of the same concerns in Haringey.
Yeah. But the thing I would strongly urge anyone talking about it or having an opinion about it outside, well, anyone trying to analyse it from outside of Haringey, and indeed because of what's now happened inside Haringey as well, actually, you don't really need to know what the HDV is about. It's okay. A bit like, so the slight problem with a lot of the kind of takes about what Haringey means for the state of Labour and the left in 2018 is it's a bit like someone going, there was a war of religion in the Germanic states in the 15th century. I really ought to know this, but
I can never do the thing where it's like if it's happened in 1600, it's actually the 17th century. But I agree. I know what you mean, right? You don't need to have a view.
Will there be a war in Germany in the 21st century?
You don't need to know whether or not the Yorkists or Lancastrians were right to think that the Wars of the Roses is an interesting conflict.
Yes, but also crucially, I think the thing is right. What you kind of need to understand is like the difference between why things have happened in Haringey and have not happened in Hackney or Camden or any of the other neighbouring boroughs is this thing called the HDV. Just as in the same way, if you want to understand why is that Zach Goldsmith resigned to fight a by-election, you have to understand that there's this thing called the third runway, but you can fairly take the view that the government is never going to actually reach a decision on the third runway, and then therefore any time you spend reaching a view on the rightness or wrongness of the third runway is time that you could use doing learn literally a
musical instrument,
anything
perhaps.
Else.
Yeah, the kazoo. And
my take on the HDV is essentially the level of expertise that you're going to require to have some kind of understanding of it in any great length, I don't really think is worth it unless you are a Haringey resident.
Okay, so in that case, then we look at what it's a proxy war for, right? Which is, as I see it, between momentum activists and whatever you want to call the old guard. I don't think actually most of them would think of themselves as Blairites, so I'm sure they're often pejoratively described in those terms, about a kind of clash between Labour institutions and newer activist members.
Even then, so Haringey is the largest local Labour Party in the country.
Is that Hornsey and Wood Green?
Hornsey and Wood Green is the largest local, but they organise as a borough party. I think they still do. Most Labour parties in cities organise either on a city-wide or, if they're big cities like London, on a borough-wide basis. I think even then, I don't think it's that helpful to view it through that prism. Essentially, in every constituency party, you have a group of people, some of whom have been around for a long time, some people have come back, who would like to replace the existing local establishment to a greater or lesser extent. You have a large chunk of new members who have, in most of the country, a not particularly developed political sense, right? And this is one of the reasons why Haringey is, I can't work out to pronounce it because I didn't study Latin, sui generis or however.
Sui generis, I would say. But who knows if that's right? I don't say it out loud.
Please write
enough.
In. Except don't write in, because how would that be helpful?
send an audio tape in.
Yeah, please send an audio tape. Some of the people who have joined in London are more politically aware. They have come from other parties of the left, or they left Labour in the 80s. So your London new member is slightly different, although there are still plenty of London members who are just people who are enthused by Jeremy who are not that
political.
But
this
political.
Is a big argument, isn't it, that runs throughout discussions of Labour and kind of speaks to some of the stuff maybe we'll talk about later, about to what extent you see new members as a welcome addition that swells the ranks of Labour, and to what extent you see them as nefarious entries bent on the destruction of everything that you hold dear, is very much an open question. I mean, maybe I've said this on the podcast before, but in some ways it is a very nice problem for Labour to have. I did an event with Jess Phillips, the Labour Birmingham Yardley MP, and Johnny Mercer, the Tory MP for Plymouth Moorview. And Jess was talking about how big her association is now, you know, and actually managing that and the relationships there is a big part of her work in the constituency. And Johnny said, well, look, you know, my associations that chose me is like, I mean, this isn't exactly right, but, you know, in this ballpark, is 8 people with an average age of 74. So some of the problems that Labour has in terms of, you know, having all these new members are problems that the Tory party would kind of quite like to have. Like having small, you know, withered local party associations is not a great answer either.
Yeah. And essentially what has happened in most local parties so far is the new members have effectively sorted themselves into a political position not dissimilar from the one of the, in fact, basically identical to the one of the Labour Party on the 12th of September 2015, or whenever it was, and Jeremy Corbyn was first elected. The thing that the HDV has successfully done, if you are someone who wanted to replace the existing councillors, or unsuccessfully if you were a councillor who's been selected, is it has polarised the Labour Party to a position to its left of what it was before 2015. Actually, the fascinating thing so far, and obviously this may change, is that Labour, other than its leader, you know, Labour was fairly solidly electing left-wing members of the NEC on the members before, and was electing kind of MPs in that kind of like slightly to, I mean, is slightly to Ed Miliband's left? Or maybe just where Ed Miliband sort of wanted to be, left without the need to have Ed Balls in his shadow cabinet.
But this is also kind of interesting question about what Momentum has done and the limits of how it has reformed the party, right? So you ended up with John Lansman and the other two candidates from the Momentum slate getting elected to the NEC, which is very important in terms of the fact there is now a kind of Corbyn, pro-Corbyn majority there. But equally well, in candidate selection, things haven't gone quite so smoothly, and actually favoured sons like, I think I'm right in saying that David Prescott, as in son of John and as in speechwriter, didn't get selected recently. It's not like that Corbyn has got this kind of complete iron grip on and is just installing his favoured lieutenants without anyone kind of, you know, without any kind of.
Yeah, although in Mansfield, the latest constituency to not select David Prescott. Yeah, no, I don't mean that nastily.
That just sounded very shady, and I'm sure you didn't mean it like that.
He has gone for selection in a number of places.
And lots of people do, yeah. Okay.
A number of people do go over in multiple places, and, you know, good luck to them. My information isn't the most likely candidate to win in Mansfield is the woman who currently leads the council, who, embarrassingly, I have forgotten the name of. I'm really sorry if you're a podcast listener, and indeed I'm really sorry to the good people of Mansfield, because I should be able to remember the name of your council leader, is considered likely to win and has kind of Corbyn-y sympathies. So,
which makes sense to select a local candidate, because this was the same thing as the row over one of the North London seats, right, which they felt was a very knife-edge one. And there was a strong argument that you elect a local candidate, you don't parachute someone into a marginal seat. And Mansfield was won by... I wrote this in a piece and I've completely forgotten how many seats the Tories won it by. Votes the Tories won it by, but it was...
few.
It was under a couple of hundred, right? It really is a proper wafer-thin marginal that Labour would definitely need to take next time.
And I think so. Some of Momentum's problems in selections this time have been slightly overwritten. Yeah, the thing about the Momentum membership is it is, as I understand it, effectively a mirror image of the Labour membership in terms of where it is strongest. And where are the vacant seats? They are... yeah, effectively, they are Labour has kind of already leveraged its membership advantage, right? So if you take, say, the Brighton constituencies, huge membership, two of those used to be marginal. Now they all have like comically large majorities. And there is not really a neighbouring seat that you can easily move your ground troops into. And so my suspicion is Momentum will do slightly better by the end of this parliament, when we'll have the retirement seats in places you would expect them to be stronger.
But the unions did a great job at the last election of carving up those, you know, some good seats for themselves, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that will continue to be the case. One of the reasons why I think that it is unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely that there will be broad rule changes is that the trade unions do quite well out of the existing arrangements. They have this problem in selections and their power is largely a negative one, and they can stop things happening. But it is hard to see what the rule change you would have that gives more power to the membership that doesn't decisively erode your power if you are a trade union leader.
Okay, so this brings us to the second bit that I wanted to talk to you about this week, which is kind of linked to it, right? Which is, you know, this idea about Momentum being this kind of evil infiltrator pack of kind of basically thinly disguised communists is something that, bless them, the Tories are trying very hard to push, right? This is one of their staple attack lines, along with it'll be like Venezuela, it'll be like the 1970s, Diane Abbott's stupid, Jeremy Corbyn went on press TV, and something about the economy, they'll do Marxists. They're all Marxists, big, you know, they want to nationalise your mum. And I think you were tweeting quite interesting stuff about the fact that the Tory attack lines are flailing around the place because they don't have proceed from an idea of what the Tory party is for at the moment, right? So you can't draw a kind of negative comparison about what Labour's doing wrong unless you have an idea about what you think you're doing right.
Well, yeah, it was one of those kind of weird moments that I was trying and failing to write my Guardian cookery column, as it happens.
What picture is it going to be this week?
The next week it is Michelle Obama.
Are you dressed as Michelle Obama?
I mean, dressed as Michelle Obama is probably putting slightly too far a point on it. I mean, sadly, you can't see my lower body, so I'm not wearing a dress. But, you know, I'm hoping, you know,
have you got your arms out at least? Your strong Michelle Obama guns.
I am doing
guns.
Like a kind of strong sort of like a bar. Well, I mean, I don't know what photos they'll have picked.
Okay.
But in any case, I was struggling and failing to be witty about cooking in the style of Michelle Obama. And I kind of started procrastinating on Twitter. And I suddenly realized if someone sentenced you ask us, what is the theme of the Conservative Party's messaging at the moment? I would have to kind of look at them for a while and go,
Labour is bad. It's Labour is bad.
But the thing is, Labour is bad.
It's not even we're getting on with Brexit, actually. They haven't really, are not making that argument particularly well at the moment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of, if you are as cool as me, right, a really good demonstration of what has gone wrong in terms of their overall messaging is to watch either of Philip Hammond's budgets, and then watch George Osborne's or actually Gordon Brown's or Dennis, or basically any Chancellor not called Philip Hammond, right? Because essentially, if the thing that Osborne did well, Gordon Brown did well, actually, even though they lost, Alistair Darling and Ken Clark both did well, is the budget is one of the few opportunities for people who are not that bothered by politics where you can kind of go, we think that this government is about X, and the question we think voters should be asking at the next election is why. So obviously under Cameron and Osborne, it was like, this budget is about making the tough choices to cut things than people who don't vote for us use in order to put some money into the things that the people who might vote for us or have voted for us care about, while overall reducing slightly the share of state spenders' GDP. And Labour won't do this. And Gordon Brown's sort of argument was effectively like, we are being responsible so we can do nice things. The Conservatives will not be responsible and are mean. The Conservatives at the moment do not have an argument that leads to, particularly because it's not even just like Labour are bad. It is Labour are bad about things that we know that, you know, quote unquote, the average voter simply does not give a flying one. I do find it a bit depressing that the only place where you can really see any kind of effect from Labour's sluggish response to anti-Semitism are seats where the community gathers in great numbers. However, we now know that to be true, right? So if you are the Conservative Party and you retain some interest in holding on to power, having one of those parliamentary majority things I hear so much about, you kind of have to accept that there is not, yeah, like there are not more votes to be harnessed from that approach. I just suddenly realised, wait a second, yeah, there is no big argument coming from the Conservatives about what they think the next election is about, which is, of course, partly because they have this horrible project that takes up all of the civil services time in Brexit.
But also, there couldn't be a bigger stamp on Theresa May that just said interim leader, right? Yeah. And that just feels... I was just going to finish by saying and tell you something that makes you kind of sad. You mentioned George Osborne. I nearly accidentally ended up in a conversation with George Osborne yesterday. I went to the theatre to see Julius Caesar at the Bridge Theatre, and I was going up to talk to someone else who I knew, who I then, just as I hit the kind of periphery of the conversation, realised that behind the pillar there was George Osborne. But he's haunting my life, Stephen, because when I went to the first night of previews for Hamilton, there was him like three rows in front of me taking selfies. And I'm just worried that I can't go to the theatre anymore without the spectre. The spectre is haunting me, the spectre of George Osborne.
Okay, so the thing I would strongly advise you to do is do not do a column on this topic. It just has like the feeling of something which would go viral and not in a good way.
It's very relatable, I think. Yeah. Lots of people will probably go, that's so true, when I go to the theatre, George Osborne's always there as well.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
Indeed.
I've been ill for the last 3 weeks, so I thought I was a celebratory, like, I no longer have a chest infection, You Ask Us. This week's You Ask Us is from Richard Fernandez on the Twitters. He even put a hashtag on it. Wow. I really feel like we've moved into the digital age here. If a Tory MP writes a letter to Graham Brady, can they change their mind and get it back? So basically what happens is the Tories have got a backbench committee, which is currently run by Sir Graham Brady, who Theresa May saw fit to give a knighthood to in the New Year's Honours List. Always helpful, who is a big proponent of grammar schools, which will also be relevant and come up. So he kind of keeps basically the kind of Tory shit list about if you decide that you think that the Tory leader is rubbish, you send a letter to him. If it reaches a certain threshold, give me...
15% of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, which at the moment is 48.
Then it triggers a vote of no confidence. If the leader loses the vote of no confidence, do they actually have to resign or is it...
Yeah, they have to. I mean, they're not like the Labour Party. They don't have like a vote, a no confidence thing, and then someone goes, oh, we don't need to build a constitutional ejector seat into this because what could possibly go wrong? No other party in the democratic world would do that.
UKIP.
No, UKIP do have an ejector seat. They just have like a...
It's broken.
They just have... UKIP's no confidence rule is hilarious, right? Because basically, the NEC can go, we'd like to have a no confidence. And then if the leader says no, there's a... So basically
well,
you...
Why haven't the leader go, I have confidence in me.
And then
and
you have
enough.
A full confidence vote at a party AGM, right?
Right.
So effectively...
That's why Henry Bolton is still... I mean, has he resigned or not? I can't remember. No, he
I
has
say, I really don't want to commit to saying whether or not Henry Bolton is still leader of UKIP or indeed still in UKIP. I worry that the theme of this episode is a list of things about which Stephen just does not have the headspace for.
That's very
but
true,
it's just simply,
you know, like you know Sherlock Holmes famously, and he didn't know that the Earth went round the sun.
Yeah.
That's sort of how I feel about UKIP now. I don't.
Well, it's like you've got to have like the Marie Kondo approach to like politics. Like, does it bring joy? No. Yeah. Like ultimately, no. Yeah.
I do think about the failure of UKIP does spark joy, but I don't need to know who is currently leader for that to happen.
Yeah.
So what happens when you get 48 letters to Graham Brady? There were reports that there were like nearly that number. And I think certainly, although who knows whether or not those are true, there is a lot of discontent. Simon Heffer writes in this week's magazine about people like Nicholas Soames, who is very much a party grandee, like Churchill's grandson, just like most Tory you can be, I guess, even though Winston Churchill was in a bunch of different parties, never mind. You know, actually sort of tweeting that the party is kind of crap. And Johnny Mercer, we mentioned in the previous section, said, you know, the window is closing. So people who are slightly, you know, independent-minded, they are not on the payroll vote, but are kind of beginning to look more and more kind of anxious about the direction of the party. So I think she's in trouble, but the question is whether or not she's in any more trouble than she has been for the vast majority of the rest of, you know, since the election.
Yeah, I mean, so I am dubious about any story which purports to have spoken to someone who knows how many people have signed their letters. Ultimately, although Graham Brady is, you know, more of a Theresa May fan than the average Conservative MP, Graham Brady is only 50, which is quite young for politics. Yeah, you know, he could reasonably expect to have a long post Theresa May career ahead of him. Part of why he keeps that job is he's respected by MPs for his discretion. I simply don't buy that he's wandering around being like, "Hey, what rhymes with 40 and is the number of letters I have?" I just don't buy that is going on. That weird clicking sound, apologies, listen, was me attempting to stimulate a wink for audio.
Yeah, but also you wouldn't say what rhymes with 40, you'd say what rhymes with hurty hate, all right, would you? I mean, otherwise you're just saying the number, Stephen.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that most people he's talking to aren't going to get... You know, kind of, you've got to spell it out for people.
Henty heaven. Yeah.
But, okay, you know, so basically
don't
that
let me
that
pick
is...
your Graham Brady mime, which was otherwise beautiful.
It just feels to me unlikely than that is what is going on. However, because no one knows how many letters there have been, and one of the, I guess, you know, I said about people not doing rule changes and they haven't really thought through. In the past, you wrote a letter, and at the end of the year, if the number hadn't gone back up to 48... then, you know, all of the letters kind of vanish.
They're cleared.
Yeah.
That's really great.
And now, if you write a letter,
yeah,
it just sits there.
But
until...
you can withdraw it, presumably. You can.
Oh, yeah, you can.
No, she's brilliant. Do you know what? That conference speech really won me over.
Yeah, no, it's not like one of those things where you kind of go, you know, okay, you know, no backsies.
When the threshold is triggered and you get to 48, do you ever find out who the 48 were? Or is it a secret ballot forever?
It's a secret ballot.
Which increases the likelihood of it happening. I mean, that is if I were designing the Tory party rules, that would be the way I would design it for maximum lols.
Yeah, I don't know. The problem... So I think, weirdly, the fact it's a secret ballot it is probably a net neutral, right? Because the fact that it's anonymous and no one knows how many they are reduces significantly the chance that someone will send a, shall we say, an expressive letter of no confidence. You know, it reduces the chances that you are, say, Justine Greening or, you know, one of the, like, many sacked junior ministers, your Mark Garnier or whatever, of you just sitting down and going, I have no confidence in Theresa May, love and kisses, Mark.
But that's what the Telegraph op-ed pages are for, surely.
Yes.
I mean, do you remember the great season of Jeremy Corbyn no confidence blogs? I mean, some of those were beautiful.
I do, sadly, have that summer scarred in the worst rooms of my memory.
Yeah, at the theatre last night, they started playing Seven Nation Army, and I had a sort of almost involuntary shiver. It's just like a Pavlovian response. It's like someone ringing a bell. I just sort of feel deeply panicked and distressed that I'm going to be made to write a blog when I hear that sound.
But basically, I think because it's anonymous, although there's the freedom to do it, the risk of doing it is significantly higher. It is true that patience among with Theresa May among Conservatives MPs is going down, and they are increasingly aware that as long as she is there, they will have no strategic, you know, kind of argument with Labour. They will have no kind of overarching vision, etc., etc. But the basic fear of a large chunk of that party, which is that if you have a Tory leadership election before Brexit, then your leadership race comes down to who is the most Brexity, won't go away. There's also this awareness that the next Conservative leadership election will be horrible for them to live through, because you have so many candidates. You have some people who are running effectively to survive, or like Priti Patel, to come back.
And you'll have some proper kneecappings as well. I mean, any leadership election, which might very well involve Michael Gove, is going to involve some dirty, dirty briefings.
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael Gove is actually quite well placed for the leadership race.
No, he offers competence. I mean, that's the thing, is he's one of the very few ministers who is currently actually, you know, out there and, you know, and doing their brief. And Boris Johnson has, I think, faded because of his lackluster performance. And like, people feel that he's been given a serious job and he has not risen to it in the party.
Obviously, the people one speaks to are always a flawed sample of any parliamentary party. I would say it is true to say that the average Conservative MP is more annoyed. However, when you actually go like, so, you know, have you done anything about this? Except obviously I don't say in quite that kind of pejorative a tone. That number is just not even close to creeping up to 15% of the Conservative MPs I speak to. So I still think, actually, despite everything, Theresa May may be in less immediate danger than we think, because
I think the thing to watch out is successor watch. I think that's the, if you want to make a calculation about Theresa May's survival, at any point does somebody getting a lot of great write-ups is obviously on manoeuvres, and is there a feeling that everybody is coalescing around one or two people?
Well, that thing is, in some ways the good thing about party conference for her was that her speech was the story of the conference, because no one else had the only one who had a good one is Ruth Davison. Ruth Davison can't become Conservative. Like, there is no safe way to get Ruth Davison from the Scottish Parliament to the Westminster Parliament. So that's nothing doing. Currently, you know, who are the other leadership candidates? Gavin Williamson, currently detonating over a fireplace.
He's not a fireplace salesman anymore, Stephen. I want you to remember that. He's left that all behind him.
Indeed, so he has. So, yeah, the answer to the question is, yes, the letters can be revoked if you want to. The letters stick around indefinitely. Who knows what number they are? Maybe by the time this comes out. I mean, this is the thing. I honestly think that when that threshold is triggered, it will actually be a big surprise to everyone, because Graham Brady keeps his cards close to his chest, right?
But I've always said this since the beginning. You know, it's one of those things where people want a prediction from you, and actually my prediction is it's incredibly unpredictable. And I wouldn't bet on it either way. So it's just more of the great political insight that you've come to expect from us. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is from the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not follow us on Twitter at @NS_podcasts?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.